For Black History Month today, we take a closer look at the birth of rap as we revisit one of our favorite segments from 2005. DJ Grand Wizard Theodore, rapper Curtis Blow, and author Jim Fricke explained the controversy and creativity that informed hip-hop's early years. Grand Wizard Theodore was the DJ who invented the scratch, making turntables a playable instrument. Jim Fricke is the editor of Yes, Yes, Y'all, the Experience Music Project's oral history of hip-hop's first decade. He was the creator of the Hip Hop Nation exhibit at Seattle's Experience Music Project Museum. And Curtis Blow was the first rapper to sign with a major label and the first to have a certified gold single. To set the scene, Blow starts by describing the economic distress of New York City in the 1970s.
Now, during that time, you had a lot of buildings that were being burnt down by the owners of the buildings, the landlords, the slumlords. They had a little scam going around. These landlords would burn down their buildings because they couldn't get people to move into the buildings, and times were just so hard. The economy was really messed up. New York was going broke. The mayor, A. Beam, had reached out to the federal government for help, and then there was a picture on the front page of the Post saying, you know, the president says no, New York.
Jim Fricke.
People didn't go there. It was scary to go there. And so one of the magical things that happened out of that was that these young kids, you know, were able, at a time when it, you know, it's interesting that such a thing could occur, to really develop a musical style, a new sort of creative art form, and let it gestate for a few years before anyone became aware of it, so that by the time in 79 and 80, people began to realize that something had been happening up there. It was really well-developed.
There were still people up in the South Bronx living in these abandoned buildings. The first sign of selfish expression from the people, because out of oppression and out of depression, there is a lot of creativity. So the people were starting writing on the walls on these abandoned buildings. People saying, look at these buildings, look at what we live in, but, you know, it's trash, it's rubble, but we're not trash and we're not rubble. We're going to try and make this place look beautiful. And then it spilled over into the trains, and that's how graffiti was born.
There was a fully developed kind of graffiti movement by 72, 73, when the very first parties that began to evolve into what we would, you know, think of as hip-hop parties were first happening. So they were kind of separate movements at the time. Where there's a real connection is, you know, this was a really interesting and kind of amazing street-level creative expression that allowed kids who really had no other means of becoming visible beyond their neighborhoods to do things that sort of took their name beyond the confines of, you know, their borough.
Early hip-hop was a way for kids to reach beyond their rough neighborhoods, but no one realized how far it would grow beyond the Bronx.
Obviously, at the time, nobody knew it was a movement. You know, they were just putting on parties, and one of the reasons that records weren't really on their mind is because they didn't really think what they were doing was something that could be captured on record. They were just, you know, putting on a party. And it's kind of developed, you know, as the mythology has developed, that hip-hop emerged in opposition to disco. And there are certainly, you know, lots of differences between hip-hop and disco, but there are actually a lot more similarities. And, you know, in the early days, up through, actually, you know, 79, nobody knew what to call this music, and they called it disco.
Right then, during that time, disco music was the hottest thing on the radio. So what we did up in the ghetto, and we partied in the parks, we partied on the streets. That's how the block parties came about. And we partied in the gyms and the community centers, because we were poor. We didn't have the $5-$10 to go downtown to the Midtown clubs to pay to get into those places. Plus, we were too young. But there was a guy by the name of Kool Herc, a DJ who moved here to the South Bronx in 1970 or 69 from Jamaica. And he loved the music that we grew up on. We grew up on in the 60s, the Motown sound. James Brown was the real godfather of soul. You know, we missed that music because disco, when disco came out, Village People, Thump Thump, Donna Summer, monotonous beats of Europe, you know, fast disco music. It got away from the soul music we grew up on. So Herc went back to that. He started playing that type of music in the uptown community centers and gyms. And it was a whole new music. It was a scene, but it was old music. But in a world of disco, it was obscure. And we sort of like lost our minds.
DJ Grand Wizard Theodore.
Back when Kool Herc was first started and I first, you know, started learning about him, I mean, I was actually in school. I had the kind of mother, she tell me, like, go to school, get your knowledge, and you can practically do anything you want to do. But, you know, I looked up to people like, you know, Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, my older brother, Mean Gene, you know, and Grandmaster Flash. I looked up to them because, you know, those were the people that introduced me to the music scene.
Fricky, in his book Yes, Yes, Y'all, draws comparisons between gang culture and the crews that sprang up around early DJs.
What happened in the Bronx was you had crews like Grandmaster Flash's crew, Kool Herc's crew, Afrika Bambaataa's crew, who operated in defined areas that were protected by, you know, their security crew. And in effect, these, you know, in some cases really directly were gangs that were sort of converted to be the security that would take care of your parties. And when you're in an area that's characterized by great poverty, just the act of taking a big sound system out into a city park is a dangerous enterprise. There are a lot of people who would like to take your speakers home or your amplifiers home or whatever, or if you're charging money, take the money home, and you need to have somebody that is going to make sure that that doesn't happen.
That changed somewhat after a blackout in New York City in July of 1977. Fricky relates a story told to him by Grandmaster Kaz of seminal group the Cold Crush Brothers and his old partner DJ Disco Wiz.
They're playing this party and all of a sudden the streetlights start to go out. And this was at a time when, in order to get the power to power their sound systems in the park, they'd actually remove a plate from a streetlight and jigger the wires and get the power off of the streetlight. So they immediately concluded that they were in trouble because they'd just sort of blown the circuits in their neighborhood, and then they noticed that lights just kept going out, and pretty soon it was dark. And the first thing that happened was, you know, the crowd started to rush their system because, you know, they could maybe steal some of it. So Kaz and Wiz, you know, sort of drew their guns and defended their system. Then the next thing they knew, they saw people running up and down the street looting, basically. And this was a story that was reported in detail in the media. And the punchline of the whole story was that the day that event occurred, there were a half dozen sound systems in the Bronx, and the next day everybody had a sound system.
DJ Grand Wizard Theodore explains how he got started on the turntables as a young teen.
You know, I was very fortunate. I was given this gift, and I didn't know that I was given this gift. My mother actually had a little stereo in her house. I'm sure everybody's mother had a little stereo, you know, a little turntable in the house. And what I used to do is I used to play like 45s, whether it be a James Brown 45 or Dennis Coffey 45 or Brass Construction or whatever, you know. When it gets to the beat part, I would usually skip the needle back so I can, you know, hear that part again, not knowing that I was developing a needle drop style all the years that I was doing it. When I finally got on the big turntables, the art form was already there. It was just up to me to display it to the people. Now, as far as the scratch is concerned, I created the scratch when I was like 12 and a half. Practiced it in the room, trying to upgrade my skills, trying to be different from all the other DJs that I've listened to, just trying to stand out and trying to have my own identity and not follow behind anybody else.
Well, at first I was the greatest dancer, so naturally I had to go to Kool Herc's parties because at the highlight of the night, the theme song, Kool Herc's number one song was James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose. And once he played that song, that was the night for all the B-boys to get out there in the circle and find out who was the baddest B-boy of the night. So I had to be there. And I was one of those dancers, very, very good, you know, young kid from Manhattan. And I remember battling this guy, Dancing Doug, also from Manhattan, the Polo Grounds. He used to dance with a partner of his called Dancing Rob. It's Dancing Doug and Robbie Rob. And they were great, a great duo. But I danced against Doug, and I think he took it. I came in second. So I might have been the second best in Manhattan.
There are really very few things that have happened, you know, in the arts where people agree that one person at one point actually developed this new thing that became influential. The fact that, you know, somebody can invent something like that and have it not be disputed is interesting to me in itself. Cool DJ Herc gets the credit for kind of being the first person to realize that they're playing these extended kind of, a lot of them were sort of disco songs that tended to have breaks in them where all the instruments would drop out and you just had kind of a percussion section. At those moments, all of the B-boys would kind of hit the floor and really show off their moves. Flash and Herc were developing this, you know, sort of simultaneously. Flash talks about how it just seemed tragic to him that the good part of the record was so short. And they had to figure out how to extend that good part of the record. So what Cool DJ Herc did was he'd have whatever song he was playing that had one of these rhythm breaks in the middle, and he'd have two copies of the same record, and one on one turntable and one on the other. And as it, you know, he played that break, as it got to the end of the break, he would start the same break on the other record and just flip the control over so that you're hearing the same thing on the second turntable. This would allow them to kind of extend that rhythm break and keep the B-boys doing their thing. Giving credit for these innovations, you know, Herc gets the credit pretty universally for being the first person to do this. A lot of people also acknowledge that he wasn't particularly smooth at it. As DJing has evolved, part of the skill is being able to flip back and forth between records on turntables and keep the beat going constant. And Herc wasn't apparently so good at that. Flash, Grandmaster Flash, was the person that, you know, really developed that into an art form. And he also, you know, invented kind of the first DJ mixer that was seen in the Bronx.
Grandmaster Flash created a style called backspin. Back then he called it the clock theory, but now people call it the backspin. It's when you grab the record and spin it back counterclockwise to the part of the record that you want to repeat. So basically what he did was he backspin the record to the part he wanted to repeat, and then he mixed the turntable over, and then he went to the other side and repeated and did the same thing, which he can, like, repeat the same part of the record without picking the needle up. And another style that he created was extending the break, meaning that if you have a break that's 10 seconds long, he can actually extend that break to a minute or 2 minutes just by, you know, mixing it back and forth and back, which is called cutting. Now, what I do is totally different. Cutting is when you cut a record off and cut the other record on. That's cutting. And basically what I did is I would just let an instrumental record play, and I would get my scratch record and move the record back and forth and forth and back without cutting it. Instead of me mixing one record off and one record on, I would just hold that one record and interject with the instrumental that I'm playing behind, which is called scratching.
While the DJ may have started out as the center of attention, as the genre grew, attention began to shift to the MC, the early version of the rapper.
The role of the MC began 10 years before, you know, Public Enemy kind of hit the stage is that the original MCs were really kind of like hype men on a certain level for the DJs. It was all about the DJs, and the DJs often weren't so great on the mic, and they had some friend who, you know, could take the mic and say, hey, you know, check this out. Really sort of focus the attention on the DJ, and then also just kind of get the crowd worked up. And that's where a lot of these chants, like yes, yes, y'all, say ho, throw your hands in the air, these kinds of things, came about. It was just, you know, the MC was there to whip the crowd into a frenzy and to, you know, kind of focus the attention on the DJ. Melly Mel and Kid Creole were two brothers who actually developed a style of MCing where they kind of, was a little more sophisticated. They interacted with one another, you know, and they did the sorts of routines that subsequently became popular, where they'd kind of, speak in counterpoint, finish each other's phrases and stuff. And they started appearing at Grandmaster Flash's parties and became part of the crew, and it became Grandmaster Flash and the three MCs. And all of a sudden, you know, the other DJs needed to have more MCs, and it just kind of gradually grew in that way until by the time the Sugar Hill Gang hit, you know, with Rapper's Delight, it was a characteristic of the, you know, the crews on the scene at the time that they had four or five MCs. And they would do routines that they worked out that would last, you know, 15 to 30 minutes.
In the beginning, the DJ was the boss. He was the focal point of the party. He controlled the pace of the party, the atmosphere. He hired and fired the MCs. The MCs were a dime a dozen. They were just announcers, you know, telling the people, you know, hey, Joey, your mom is at the door. You better go check her out. It's 11:30. Or, you know, hey, John, your car is a double parked outside. There's a cop outside. We got to get your ticket, license plate number, you know. We'd make announcements. But then it evolved to where we started to become entertainers ourselves, like DJ Hollywood would have skits and rhythmic raps and throw your hands in the air, somebody say oh yeah, and have a lot of crowd response. And then the actual, I say, the solidification of the changing of the guards was the actual rap record. When the rap record came out, the MC got a chance to put his vocals on a song, and he was the writer and the focal point of the actual song. And that's basically when it happened.
Well, what I feel is that, you know, corporate America, these record companies that's only worried about money is not worried about preserving the true culture of the art form. You know, B-boys are hard to endorse. Graffiti writers are hard to endorse, and DJs are hard to endorse. So what corporate America did was they took the MC and put him in the front by himself, and then they called him a rapper, you know, and they just ran with it, started making dats and stuff like that, you know, and basically just pushed the DJ to the side. But a lot of people don't understand that the DJ is the one that sets the pace for the party. Back in the early days, the DJ was the one that he owned the turntables, he owned the mixer, he owned the records, he owned the speakers. He went out, he got the flyers made, he owned the microphone. All the MC had to do was come to the venue, pick up the microphone, say whatever he's gonna say, put the microphone down, and go back into the crowd, and the DJ is still there playing. And when the party is over, the DJ got to pack up his records, pack up his mixer, pack up his turntables, pack up his speakers, pack up his amplifiers, pack up his mic. You know, he got to do all of this stuff, and the DJ is the one that basically set the tone for the hip-hop music today.
In 1979, with the release of Sugar Hill Gang's song Rapper's Delight, hip-hop was brought to millions of people outside of New York. Fricky explains the controversy that surrounded that song's release.
Rapper's Delight is a great example of this, you know, sort of combination of misunderstandings that can lead to all sorts of animosity. Hip-hop had been going on, depending on, you know, whose version of the story you believe, or when you decide it becomes hip-hop, for at least a few years. there were a lot of parties happening by 77, 78, 79. You know, it was fully formed as, you know, what I would call an art form. Yet none of these crews were making records. They really didn't even think of it, and which was something that was interesting to me. And I asked a number of people, because I, you know, during that same period I was in bands, and the first thing we thought of was, you know, making a record, whether or not we had any real reason to believe anybody would care. But you know, you'd ask people, you know, well, so you're writing all of these rhymes and developing all these amazing routines, and, you know, you're playing parties night after night, you know, getting this incredible response and packing houses, and you never thought of making a record. And they'd say, well, just, I mean, we did parties, you know, how could you put a party on a record? Our routines were 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's, you know, it wasn't the kind of thing that went onto records. And Sylvia Robinson, who was one of the key figures at Sugar Hill Records and somebody who was a veteran of the music business, became aware of, you know, this, the popularity of this movement through her son Joey. And, you know, it's a long story, but the short version of it is, you know, she kind of, the light went off in her head and said, geez, this is so popular, I bet if we could put this on a record I could make some money. She didn't know Grandmaster Flash or Cool Herc or whoever. And, you know, one thing that you do in the music business, when you find something new, is you put a band together and try to capitalize on a new movement. So the Sugar Hill Gang was kind of just cobbled together as a studio band. They didn't use a real DJ. They, you know, this, one of the interesting things about early hip hop records is, you know, they actually had studio bands kind of recreating what DJs were doing on stage at the time. The record came out and was a smash, and immediately everyone who felt that they should have been on that record was mad at the Sugar Hill Gang. Within weeks, Grandmaster Flash had, and the Furious Five had a record out, you know, Funky 4+1 had a record out, Afrika Bambaataa kind of held off for a little while, and Cool Herc barely ever got around to it. But there was, you know, remain a lot of hard feelings about that, because that record became huge, Rapper's Delight. And, you know, the fact is, they obviously knew something about what they were doing, because they were able to make the record, whether or not they were central to the scene. And really, they were on the record because Sylvia thought of it. I said a M-A-S, a T-E-R, a G with a double E. I said I go by the unforgettable name of the man they call a Master G. Well, my name is known all over the world by all the foxy ladies and the pretty girls. I'm going down in history as the baddest rapper that ever could be. Now I'm feeling the highs and you're feeling the lows. The beat starts getting into your toe. You start popping your fingers and stomping your feet and moving your body while you're sitting and you're sitting. Then damn.
While the Sugar Hill Gang was the first to introduce rap to people outside of New York, it was Curtis Blow who became the first rap star. He was the first to sign with a major label and embark on an international tour. He explains what his label thought when his song The Breaks went gold.
They were just looking and anticipating, and they really didn't know. You know how bureaucracies are. There are many different departments in the corporation, and of course, one doesn't know what the next is doing, and they generally don't have their ear to the street, so they don't know what's going on. But when The Break sold like 900,000 copies, they sat back and went, wow, This is incredible. I got a full-length album deal. You know, I was in the right place at the right time, got the opportunity to make the actual first certified gold rap song. The Breaks was really, really... The Breaks for Curtis Blow.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Cause I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are The Breaks. Breaks in a bus, breaks on a car, breaks to make you a superstar. Breaks to win and breaks to lose, but these here breaks will rock your shoes.
Many things have changed since that first major hit, Curtis Blow explains what he would like today's rappers to take away from those early days.
I wish they would have more fun live on stage and the things that they talk about. You know, we were basically talking about fun things back then and trying to create fun in the atmosphere where we went or we performed or wherever we were. You know, that was our job, to just have a good time. There was a code of ethics back in the day. We were definitely concerned about profanity on the microphone. I think people can express themselves without profanity in the Bible. It says life and death are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it shall eat its fruit. We need to stay away from profane communication. That's my opinion. And the last thing is that I see a lot of the kids of today cupping the microphone. That's taking their hand and holding it all over on top of the microphone, so it distorts the sound of them singing live, and that's not cool. We need to keep that traditionally sounding correct by thinking of ourselves as entertainers and singers, and we can't cup the mic because that distorts the sound.
Breaks on a plane, breaks on a train, breaks to make you go insane. Breaks in love, breaks in war, but we got the breaks to get you on the floor, and these are the breaks. Break it up, break it up, break it up, break down.
Curtis Blow with his breakthrough rap hit, The Breaks, finishing up our history of the early days of hip-hop, the birth of rap, originally broadcast in 2005, and we bring it back to you for Black History Month. Just incredible to hear these stories of what happened. We'll get to music from Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, and that's coming up when we get back here to the World Cafe.